Why was an earthquake in Virginia felt at more than twice the distance than a similar size earthquake in California? The answer is one of many that people may not realize. Earthquakes east of the Rockies can cause noticeable ground shaking at much farther distances than comparably sized earthquakes in the West. Scientists are researching a variety of factors that influence regional differences in the intensity and effects of earthquakes. Some of the factors have to do with the nature of the underlying tectonic plates and their geologic history. Others are connected to the size and age of buildings. Fascinating, isn't it? Well, in a moment, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lucy Jones, a seismologist. The Big Ones, that's her book. Can we get hit by a big one soon? Let's find out on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Lucy Jones with us, seismologist for the U.S. Geological Survey for more than 30 years, most recently a science advisor for risk reduction. She created the Great Shakeout Drill. That was an earthquake preparedness experiment that by 2016 included 53 million participants around the world. She founded and is the chief scientist of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society, a research associate at Caltech. She holds a PhD in geophysics from MIT and a BA in Chinese language and literature from Brown University. Dr. Lucy Jones with us, first time on Coast to Coast. Lucy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved in your interest in geophysics? How did that happen?
Well, as a child, my dad was an aerospace engineer and worked on the Apollo project.
Uh-huh.
We watched the moon landing together, and I told him as pretentiously as only a child can that I was going to become an astrophysicist and live on the moon.
I love it.
Of course, by the time I got my degree, it was pretty clear we weren't getting to the moon anytime soon. And I also began to realize that physics was really, in the 70s, was mostly about making bombs. And geophysics turned out to be about playing in the mountains and getting paid for it.
Does it drive you nuts when you hear people say we never went to the moon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, one thing about being a scientist is you believe that there is objective reality, and you use your tools to try and understand what that is. And looking at all the evidence, it's pretty clear what actually happened. Of course, I was there. I saw the Apollo. I went to my dad's office and saw it and touched it. And
yep.
It was a very real experience.
And I knew a couple astronauts, Edgar Mitchell, the late Edgar Mitchell being one, Buzz Aldrin. I know these guys went to the moon.
I know. I think there is, actually, I sometimes think we need to wonder why people are driven to refuse to believe that. It's, some deep psychological need is being satisfied.
Or distrust. There's distrust in government, I think.
Yes.
And that's unfortunate, too. And I've always contended that if anything happened, some of the pictures that were done on the settings, I remember watching Walter Cronkite when this happened. I was 19 years old. And they had they would have astronauts on a mock set trying to show us what was happening on the moon. I'm wondering if some pictures like that got mixed in with the real stuff, and these people said, aha, they never went. Look.
I don't think people who are saying that need evidence. I think it is being driven more by psychological needs.
Yeah, that could be.
Out there.
That could be. So tell me about the shakeout drill, and how did you get 53 million people around the world to become part of that?
Well, it began much smaller than that, though. I was the scientist leading an effort called the Shakeout Scenario, which was trying to make the science more usable by connecting it to what people were really thinking about. So we have all our papers about what's going on in various geophysical phenomena. Turn it into a coherent picture of what the big earthquake's really going to be like. And we called it the Shakeout Scenario. And there were some aspects of it that were surprising even to us, understanding how bad the fire after the earthquakes were going to be, for instance. And we wanted to help people understand what was in there, what they should really be concerned about. And we came up with we talked to social scientists and said, how do we get people to do this? How do we get them to listen? And one of the strong messages is we needed to do something that you could see people getting ready for earthquakes, that it's a strong human need to do what you see other people doing. The visual reinforcement's important. So we came up with practicing what's the best action during an earthquake, which is drop, cover, hold on, meaning drop to the ground before the earthquake sends you there, hold on to something, and, you know, hopefully have it cover your head. And, you know, that's a very visual picture, people jumping under their desk, and that would show people getting ready for earthquakes. So we did it for the shakeout scenario, and we tried to get it to as many people in Southern California as possible, about 20 million residents in the area, and we ended up getting 5 million people participating in that first drill. And I was sort of like, great, we got them to listen. But the state went, you could get one quarter of the population to participate? Wow, we better do this again. At which my first thought was, over my dead body, I already gave you a year, this is enough. But other people have really, you know, stepped in and helped put it together. A big part of it is all internet-driven, so we don't have to talk individually to everybody. We're engaging. They can sign up through it. And as, you know, California did it, other states noticed. Washington started doing it, Oregon. And then, you know, other states noticed. And then other countries started noticing. And the 53 million people is actually involving people from around the world. When Japan joined, that was a large group of people. And actually, Korea has 8 million people participating, mostly through their schools. And then actually Iran joined in. They have one of the biggest earthquake risks in the world.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
and their schools have started doing it, too.
And their buildings crumble pretty darn fast, don't they?
There's some pretty bad buildings there, yes.
Is it my perception, Dr. Jones, or are we facing the big one in this country?
What I'm trying to say within the book is that every city, every significant city in the world has a big one in their future. It's not necessarily an earthquake, but all of the things that make human life work, rivers and oceans, that lead to the potential for natural disasters. And we all will at some point, but we don't know when. And it may be hundreds of years or more for many cities. And that bothers us as human beings. We don't like it being random, but we don't know which one will be next. We just know it's going to happen somewhere.
Yeah, it's not a matter of if, it's just when. And that's the same with an asteroid strike, I think.
Right. Now, the when on the asteroid strike, you know, it's on average, what is it, every 50 million years. So it's not something you should be keeping high in your worry sphere. There's a lot of other things to hurt you before then. But
just want to hope you're not wrong.
Well, on average, I'm pretty sure I'm right. I just don't know whether the next one's in 50 million years or tomorrow.
That's right. That's right. I remember being in the Midwest in 93 during the great flood there, and they called it the 500-year flood. But the problem is once you've had that flood, you don't know if the next 500-year flood is going to start the next day or not.
There's actually been quite a bit of discussion that we shouldn't be using the terminology, because what's called a 500-year flood is really the flood that has a 1 in 500 chance in happening in any one year.
Right.
And that's a random distribution. Whether you have it this year or not does not affect your chances of having it next year. Earthquakes aren't that far off that process. I mean, we don't think they're going to show up one year right after the other. For instance, there's one part of the San Andreas where we've dug in and been able to map out the soils disrupted in previous earthquakes and date them. And one place where the average time between earthquakes is about 100 years, we have three of them that were less than 50 years apart, one only 30 years apart, and another one, there was a 350-year interval. So the earthquakes are very erratic as well.
What makes these tectonic plates move, Doctor?
Heat. Just like in the basis of storms in the end is heat in the atmosphere, the basis of the earthquake motions is heat within the earth. The core of the earth has a lot of radioactive material. It generates heat. Things that are hot want to get cooler. Things that are cooler want to get hotter. You end up getting convection cells that move the hot rock from down below up to the surface where it cools down. Just like, you know, pouring cream into your coffee and the two, the hot and the cold liquid mix, rocks, of course, move much more slowly, so it takes a few hundred million years for these convection cells to turn over. But it's the same fundamental physics.
I'm concerned about the caldera at Yellowstone. They say it pops every 600,000 years, and it's way overdue. How dangerous is that?
I am not overly concerned about it because overdue doesn't mean a lot for what I just said. We may have a long average time, but how long it's been since the last one doesn't matter very much in setting the risk. And a once every 600,000 year recurrence time doesn't lead to a lot of risk right now.
Is there any telltale signs when something like this could happen?
It depends on your hazard. Now, volcanoes, yes, the magma has to get from the magma chamber to the Earth's surface, and you can often see it moving through earthquakes and bulging and maybe some gases being released. So volcanoes don't usually erupt completely without notice. Earthquakes, there's nothing that has to happen before the earthquake can begin. So those really do come completely out of the blue.
Now, they do say if caldera goes, it could be a disaster of biblical proportions. Do you agree with that?
If it goes in that full, you know, if we get an absolute repeat of what we saw 750,000 years ago, yes.
Great.
There are a lot of ways it could erupt that wouldn't be so catastrophic.
Now, what fault is the worst in this country, San Andreas or the New Madrid?
Oh, I'd actually say the Cascadia Fault in the Pacific Northwest.
Really? Okay.
Well, all right, so it depends on what you mean by worst. Is it the biggest earthquake, the most damage, or the most frequent damage?
Well, I guess most damage has to do with exactly where it would hit, right?
Right. Well, so the epicenter doesn't matter. What matters is what surface moves in the earthquake, because every point on the surface gives off energy. To be a magnitude 8, that surface needs to be 250 to 300 miles long. So when the southern San Andreas moves, it won't matter where the epicenter shows up, because it'll be the whole southern San Andreas. That wraps around Los Angeles, runs through San Bernardino and Palm Springs, and is one of the most damaging. Actually, that is probably about the most damaging earthquake that we can imagine.
I've been in a couple little earthquakes. I spend my time between St. Louis and L.A., and St. Louis got hit years ago with a 3.4, which was pretty big for St. Louis at that time. And I've been in a 3-plus here in Los Angeles, but really nothing bigger than that. I guess you really can start to feel them after that, though, right?
Well, it depends how close you are, too. I mean,
yeah.
We've had, you know, there was a magnitude 5.3, right, a couple of weeks ago offshore from Los Angeles.
That's right.
I didn't feel a thing in Pasadena because I was just too far away. So if you're right on top of an event, you can feel down to the high twos. I once felt a 2.7 extremely clearly because it was located practically directly underneath my house.
Were you here when the Northridge one hit?
Yes. I was in Pasadena, and I did a lot of the response to that earthquake. I was monitoring the aftershocks. My research was about the patterns that aftershocks form as they occur.
Did you know old Jim Berkland before he passed away?
Yes, I do. I definitely got letters from him trying to convince me he knew how to predict earthquakes.
Good guy. He would do strange things by, for example, looking in the newspaper at animal disappearances. And he said that which I want to talk with you about, but he would say that if animals are disappearing in those kinds of numbers, they sense something. Do they have that capability?
Not really. I mean, other people tried to see whether or not his results were actually, you know, had any statistical validity, and it really did look like randomness. And never underestimate the human ability to find patterns in a random distribution. And no one else has been able to come up with a correlation as he said it was supposed to be there.
Do we have instruments that can pinpoint an upcoming earthquake?
Nope.
We still don't.
Very fundamentally random, because there's the big issue is you don't want us to predict every earthquake. right? I'll predict an earthquake. There's going to be an earthquake in Southern California today.
There always is.
Because there always is, the small ones. What you want is a prediction of which one of those, you know, dozens we're recording every day is going to become the one that's big enough to do some damage, you know, the one every year that's actually up to magnitude 5. So it's not just predicting the earthquake. You want to predict the magnitude. And that means you would need to have something that happened differently for a big earthquake to begin than a small one. And that's where the problem lies. As far as we can tell, the small and the large earthquakes begin in exactly the same way, so that anything that's happening before the big earthquake is also happening before all the small ones and is therefore happening all the time.
Historically, what has been the biggest earthquake the planet has ever registered?
9.5. The Great Chilean Earthquake of 1960 is the largest that we've ever seen on instrumental records. It was on a fault that was longer than the state of California.
Jeez.
So the magnitude of the earthquake is controlled by the area of the fault that moves times how much one side slips past the other in that event. And that was a fault in the southern part of Chile that was over 1,000 miles long.
Now, for something that big, how long is it rumbling?
11 minutes.
That's a long time.
It's an extremely long
time. It's constant, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, Northridge lasted for 7 seconds.
And that would throw you.
What?
That would even throw some. If I were standing where Northridge was for 7 seconds, you could probably get knocked over, right?
Right, right. Now, if you were standing on top of some part of the Chilean fault, you were not getting knocked over for 11 minutes, right? Because the reason it lasts so long is the fault's so long. So it starts at one end of the fault and ruptures up the fault just like tearing a piece of paper.
So it's kind of wavy as it goes?
Right, and so the energy, so think about it when you tear a piece of paper. You hear the noise as the rip goes through.
Yeah.
Right, so that noise are waves being generated. And if you're generating those waves on the fault and the rip is coming up the fault at you, and it moves up the fault at 2 miles a second, 1,000 miles, it would take 500 seconds to travel that distance, but some of it's coming at you from 1,000 miles away, right?
That's true.
That stuff doesn't going to be knocking you over. That will have really died off. So what you experience is a very long, low-level shaking, and then usually about 20, 30 seconds of really strong shaking as the rupture goes past you.
Are you more concerned about tsunamis or land-based earthquakes?
In California,
okay.
Land-based.
Land-based.
The type of big fault that produces tsunamis is not off of L.A. or San Francisco. It only begins up at Cape Mendocino and travels up into Canada. So if you live in Oregon and Washington, the tsunami is very deadly in the places that it hits, right? But it's essentially a short-term rise in sea level. And if you have a 50-foot tsunami, which is very big.
And powerful.
And very powerful, the very strong currents, everything that water goes through is getting pulled away. But if you are 50 feet above sea level, it doesn't hit you.
That's a good one. Stay with us. Dr. Lucy Jones with us. We'll be back and talk more. Her book is called The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Lucy Jones with us. Lucy, let's go back to the moment of Pompeii, that disaster that killed so many people. Did they have a warning?
Yes. In fact, 90% of the residents of Pompeii escaped with their lives. The eruption began with what's called a Plinian eruption. It went straight up into the air. Everybody saw this. And some people responded to it by leaving right away. The eruption continued, filled the air with lots of ash, became dark as night, they described it, and many people ran away at that point. There were just a few people that said, no, it's falling, you know, it's raining rocks on you. What are you doing going out there? I'm staying in my house where I'll be safe with that. And then eventually the eruption transformed into what's called a pyroclastic flow, where the gases became so heavy they started flowing down the mountain instead of going up into the air, and that superheated gas flowed down into the town and killed the remaining people.
79 AD, right?
That's right. And so it was just after the a new emperor had just come in at Rome, who had been the general that conquered Jerusalem. And so some people at the time said this was the punishment for the sacking of Jerusalem.
What about Mount St. Helens? How much time did we have on that one?
Well, the first warning for that one was over 3 months before the event.
3 months? Wow.
Yeah, because this is where if you're monitoring and you can record the small earthquakes and you record changes in gases and looking at the ground bulging, all of those are signs that the magma is moving. We call it unrest in a volcano. And it started showing up in February in 1980. And I think it was actually in February that the U.S. Geological Survey had an earthquake watch or a volcano watch and recommended evacuating the area. And when it actually erupted, it was supposed to be a mandatory evacuation zone. The people who died were all ignoring that evacuation order.
Now, what about Kilauea in Hawaii? This thing has been active for how many years now?
Oh, it's over more than three decades. There's quite a few different ways in which a volcano can erupt, and it depends upon what are the chemicals in the magma. So something like Mount St. Helens or Vesuvius, you have a lot of quartz in the magma, and it makes it sticky. It traps gases and steam and turns explosive. At Kilauea, it's a much less quartz-rich magma. It doesn't hold on to the gases the same way, and when it erupts, it just flows out over the ground with the lava, and you have none of these really explosive events.
Can we really defend ourselves against any of these?
Absolutely. Now, the volcanoes are the hardest. You know, when a volcano is going to erupt, it's going to erupt, and there's not a lot you can do about that. You can probably get out of the way, so it depends on what you mean by defend. If you're saving your life, sure, you get out of the way. You've lost your farmland, you've lost your house or whatever. Earthquakes, we can't get out of the way. We don't know when they're coming, but we can build buildings that don't fall down. And it is quite possible, if you just choose to do it, to have a building that's quite resilient to earthquakes. And you can build, they now have developed water pipes that don't break. Actually, Los Angeles has committed to a long-term process, but they've committed and started down it, of switching out the water pipes in the ground with earthquake-resilient pipes, so we'll still have water after the earthquake.
Dr. Lucy Jones with us. Her book is called The Big Ones. Her website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, by the way. Do you make predictions, Lucy?
Not of earthquakes, no.
You
no
do
one
not.
Can.
Okay.
I make statements of reliable scientific fact, like there will be an earthquake in California today.
Accurate. That's accurate.
Because I didn't specify the magnitude, right?
That's right.
And in the long run, the probability of a San Andreas earthquake is 100% as long as you give me enough time. And I think it's one of our challenges. This is what I write about in the book, actually. In dealing with these processes, they're spatially predictable. We know where they're going to happen, but they are temporally random. We don't know when they're going to happen. And as humans, we hate randomness. And we come up with a lot of ways to try and make patterns, even when they don't exist. I mean, we find constellations in stars. We are very good at finding patterns in random distributions. And it's so scary to have them come at, you know, out of the blue, that we do a lot to make up those patterns. We don't believe the animals can tell us. We think they happen in the early morning. We come up with earthquake weather. All of those are patterns that when you test them with statistics don't hold up, but we want to believe in them so badly we often do even without the data.
Did the earthquake that turned the Mississippi in the other direction really happen like that?
Yes, actually. That earthquake happened on what's called a thrust fault. So one side moved up and over the other. That's like what happened in the Northridge earthquake. The mountains grew by a couple of feet.
Jeez.
Well, the mountains that grew by a few feet in the Missouri earthquake lay underneath the Mississippi River. So there's essentially a little dam showed up, and it pulled up the Mississippi behind it, and it flowed backwards until enough water had accumulated to get around this new obstruction.
The Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 that killed well over a quarter million people, how did it take them all by surprise like that?
It shouldn't have. Nobody had spent the money to set up a warning system for the Indian Ocean.
Oh, geez.
After the big Chilean tsunami and Alaskan tsunami in 1960 and 1964, the U.S. paid for a Pacific Basin warning system, but it explicitly said warnings are to be issued for the countries on the Pacific Rim. And when the Indian Ocean earthquake happened, I got an email with probably 15 minutes after the earthquake that said 8.8, it ended up finally getting up at 9.2, has just occurred on this on the western edge of Sumatra. And I looked at that, and I knew right then that there was a big tsunami being generated, but that didn't let me give a warning to anybody. And nobody'd ever set up the system to transmit the warning or train people what to do if they got a warning.
Can you see a tsunami coming when you're on shore?
Yes, but by then it's probably too late.
And it must look huge. It must look like a wall.
It depends on how big it is as it's coming in. But yes, and actually, sometimes the first motion will be away from you, and therefore, the sea will draw down. And
it pulls it way out, right?
It can. It depends on how big the tsunami is. But yes, it pulls it way out, and then it comes way back in. We tell people in the Pacific Basin we should get a warning on a more distant one. The thing is, you're not going to get much warning, if any, if it's nearby you. But you'll feel, if it's a big enough earthquake to create a tsunami, you better believe it will have been a really big, it'll feel like an extremely strong earthquake.
If you're on a ship and the tsunami hits in the ocean,
you don't notice.
You don't notice. It goes right under you, right?
Right. It's less than many of the waves that are passing through the ocean anyway. If you're in a harbor, it can be devastating, and a lot of the damage is actually damage to ships and boats in harbors as the strong currents throw the boats up against the piers and whatever.
Just amazing. If you had to be in one of these episodes, earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, which one would you want to be in?
I would love to be in an earthquake out in the open. Because if there's no buildings,
like a desert or something like that,
yeah, be out near the San Andreas, out in, near Palmdale or something like that. Watch the fault go by, maybe get thrown into the air, but if there's nothing to fall down on me, I'm going to be okay.
Would it throw you in the air?
Yeah, we've definitely recorded ground motions that exceed the force of gravity, And then there's been a couple of instances, like in the 1989 MoMA Beta earthquake up in the Bay Area. That earthquake really happened up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And at one of the cabins or houses up in there, we found an upside-down grand piano.
And I've got to tell you, too, with all this incredible work that's out there, how vulnerable are we in North America compared to Iran, China, places like that? Where do we stand?
We are one of the best places. There is something called the International Code Council, and that tells you how to build buildings that won't kill you. And it's well carried out in the United States. We're in really pretty good shape, much better than many other countries. Not as good as Japan. Japan has probably got the best buildings, partly.
Except for Fukushima, right?
Well, right. But that was not the earthquake. That was from the tsunami.
The tsunami did that. But the earthquake caused the tsunami.
The earthquake caused a tsunami, but the ground shaking, the power plant did perfectly fine because of the ground shaking. In fact, what happened in Fukushima was flooding of the backup generators that kept the power going to cool the reactors after the countrywide power system went down with the shaking of the earthquake. But I would rather be in a Japanese building than most other places, or a building at Caltech,
Aha.
because Caltech has never would never dream of building just to the earthquake code. They start by adding 50% to the strength requirements from the code, and then they decide what else to add. USC does the same thing now too, because these are
Smart.
places that understand earthquakes and are building to own. And our building code does a great job of protecting your life, but it does a very bad job of protecting your financial investment because that's not its objective. The code says if you crawl out alive, it's a success. And so we build to the absolute minimum that keeps it from killing you, and that often leads to complete financial devastation. And there's actually a move in California right now to try and increase the standards of the code, saying we need better than disposable buildings. We're going to live through the earthquake, but can our society keep on functioning? And we can't if we don't have any buildings to go to work to or buildings to live in. So we're hoping to move the code from life safety to a functional recovery standard, something that you can get the function back pretty quickly after the earthquake.
And you talk about 6 steps to suggest people take before a natural disaster hits. I'll go through them. Tell us what they mean. Educate yourself. Obvious, I guess.
Well, yeah, that one's pretty obvious. Everybody has a natural disaster. You should figure out what are the most likely ones for you and actually go and look at what the scientists are saying. Because, you might be terrified of earthquakes, but where you live, what the really big risk is flood or wildfire.
Don't assume the government has you covered, i.e., Hurricane Katrina.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is don't underestimate people's ability to be incompetent. But also,
Right.
what I was just talking about, that the building code isn't trying to protect your investment. It's only trying to protect your life. And even more, building codes are not retroactive. So when we figure out that some way of building a building is actually pretty dangerous, and we change the code to not allow it, that doesn't make all of the existing buildings disappear. And if you have a house that's built to anything earlier than the most recent code, in California would be 1997, you can do something to make it safer. Every time I've bought a home, the first thing we've done is bring in a foundation specialist to tell us whether or not we could do something to make the building stronger. And usually there's something we can do. We've never spent more than $1,500.
That's not bad. And they know what they're doing, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely contractors. There's a training pro from the California Earthquake Authority. There's other places that have training programs as well.
Number 3 of 6, engage with local leaders.
Well, when we sometimes say that all disasters are local, but that also means that all resilience is local. If you want to live through the event, have your city be functioning, that's really up to local government. And an elected official, in general, wants to do what's good for his community, but he can only do what constituents want of him. So if you care about having good earthquake codes or not building in the floodplains or doing all of these things that can make us safer in all of these disasters, your elected officials need to know that it matters to you if you want to get it done.
Work with your community.
Well, this to me is probably the most important one. We're focused on the life safety, and we're focused about our individual risks. And if you listen to what the government tells you about disasters, you're going to be on your own, you need to protect your family, you need to be ready. And that's really a very isolating message. But if we want to recover, we need to be doing it with the larger community. And so I would encourage don't just go and get your own earthquake supplies. Go to your church and make sure that they're going to be ready to be there and help everybody afterwards. And we'll have a stronger community for it.
Speaking of that, remember that disasters are more than the moment at which they happen.
Well, this is, again, because of our fear of randomness, we're focused on that one moment when the earthquake or the volcano or whatever it is happens, and we worry about our life safety. But most of the damage is preventable, and most of the, in fact, risk to your lives is preventable by making decisions beforehand. But we have to think about that time before. And then the other piece is, again, you're probably going to live through it. 90% of the victims in Pompeii lived through it.
That's right.
What matters is whether your community is going to be living through it.
And lastly, think for yourself. Obvious, isn't it?
It is obvious, but it isn't. You know, the scientists tell you whatever, so I need to do this, or I need to do that, or whoever you're listening to. But if you use a bit of common sense and logic, you can figure out what matters for you. And in the end, you're the only one who's going to be able to keep yourself safe.
All right, up next, we're going to take phone calls with Dr. Lucy Jones as we continue chatting about major catastrophes that happen on this planet all the time. The Big Ones, that's the name of her book. We'll tell you how you can get that, too, when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Donna is in for Tom tonight, getting ready to take your calls. We will be back.